You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Dr. Judith Rodin has served as the president of the Rockefeller Foundation since 2005. Before that appointment, she was president of the University of Pennsylvania, the first woman president of an Ivy League institution. In each of those positions, she has studied and applied the concept of building resilience to address problems. She joins me today to discuss her book, The Resilience Dividend. It's published by Public Affairs. And I'm so happy it brings you to the studio. Judith, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
So you began your career as an academic. What did you receive your doctorate in?
In social psychology from Columbia, which is an extraordinary discipline because it really is looking at what are the variables in the situation that make people behave the way they do, not just their personal characteristics, but what's going on in the environment, the world, that also is influencing their behavior.
So when did you begin your studies in resilience?
Actually, at the individual level, when I got to Yale, I was on the Yale faculty for a number of years, and I was really interested in the question of why predictability and perceived control seem to have so much positive impact on people's outcomes. So if you give up, if you're helpless, if you're always sort of blaming yourself, you don't succeed the next time. So you're resetting yourself almost to a lower baseline. Whereas if you're looking for explanations in the environment, if you feel that you could do better next time, it enhances your sense of control and you actually do better next time.
Was there in those early years, was there a particular situation or case that inspired you?
In the early years, we were studying the enormous difference in how people age and why some people seem to age so successfully and others do not.
When you say age successfully, that means they're still up and at them.
Yeah, they're active, they are positive in their outlook, they really, and so to take the hardest way to study that, we actually studied all people who were already in nursing homes, and we randomly assigned them to two different groups. One got much more increased control, choices over what they ate, the hours that people visited them, when they went to sleep. Not big deal things for you and me in the real world, but in the constrained environment of a nursing home, a pretty big deal. And then the others were treated as usual. And we found extraordinary differences between the two groups in outcomes. And so the people who had more control, first of all, they complained more, which turned out to be a really good thing because it got the attention of the staff. But they started to improve psychologically. They were more cheerful. They were more positive in their outlook. And when we went back a few years later, they actually had performed better biologically and they were in better health.
That leads to a question I want to ask you, not to get too far afield, but what part does genetics play?
Well, genetics,
or is it a minor factor?
No, genetics plays some part, but we have shown that resilience is a learned skill. It's not an inherited trait. And that's really good news because it means that you can practice it, you can develop it, and you can improve both your individual and personal resilience. And then as we went on to show the resilience of your institution or your community or your city.
Right. I was going to ask you, what made you think those traits would be transferable to governments and corporations, but we'll get to that in a second. So shortly after you became president of Penn, there was a tragedy on campus. What happened?
About 2 months afterwards, somebody was murdered in a graduate student research postdoc was murdered in the area surrounding the university, West Philadelphia. That's a tragedy that would have had full-blown consequences for anyone. But for me, it was personal. I grew up in that neighborhood as a kid. I went to public schools in West Philadelphia, and I went to the University of Pennsylvania as an undergraduate. And what I saw when I came back was an incredibly deteriorated neighborhood. Businesses closed, 1 in 5 houses boarded up, almost the lowest grades in terms of elementary school grades and middle school grades in all of Pennsylvania. And I looked at that murder as an opportunity to do something really extraordinarily different, not to just increase our policing, not to get more students off the street, which was the prior response and often is the response in communities where there's danger, but rather to deeply engage the community and work together on economic development, mm-hmm. on housing rehab, building new schools together, great public schools where there was a lot of community involvement, and we transformed the neighborhood.
So how long into your tenure as president did this murder happen? Was it early?
2 months.
2 months in.
And it was shocking. And many people advised me not to take on the neighborhood. I'm a, as you said, the first woman to lead an Ivy League university. I had a lot of eyes on me in terms of what I should be doing to focus on the academic curriculum, to focus on the students. But Jonathan, my view was that you can't train your students to be civically engaged citizens going forward if you're not a civically engaged institution yourself. And so we had to walk the walk.
And so that meant breaking down what's commonly called the town gown divide.
Absolutely.
And so as an institution, how did the university go about knocking down that town gown divide?
Well, the subtitle of the book I wrote on this is called Out of the Ivory Tower and Into the Streets. And that's exactly what we did. Everyone in my administration, all the vice presidents and all the deans, had particular roles in how they were going to be responsible for engaging the community. And we no longer talked about what we would do for the community, but what we would do with the community. And that is a critical single word change, but one that is transformational because everything was collaborative. Everything was jointly planned. And there was a lot of debate and dialogue and animus. This wasn't a new situation. This was 40 years
right.
of a big urban institution, which happens all over New York as well, intruding into the neighborhood, taking space away from the people who think they live there, and exercising their rights to be big and famous.
Right. And so how did the so when you start going about trying to knock down that wall between the town and the university, the community, what was the community's reaction at first?
Oh, complete disrespect. And I do think, and I'm very fortunate in that regard, that having grown up there and gone to public schools, that I had more credibility than somebody else trying that. But it was still very tough. And many, many town hall meetings, you know, I would walk away and having just been yelled at for the last 45 minutes. And deservedly, because Penn had made so many mistakes, and so has Columbia, and so has NYU. And, you know, we see these universities so pressed for space and often believing what they were doing was in the best interests of everyone. But the history of all of these intrusions shows that wasn't the case.
Did you find resistance? So that's the community piece. What about on campus? Were there people who were resistant to what you were trying to do?
Tremendous on-campus resistance because we spent Penn money. Developers no longer believed that you could fix West Philadelphia. And this was a time when Philadelphia was incredibly strapped. You remember that this was when Ed Rendell, as mayor, was taking on the unions and cleaning the toilets in City Hall himself to show that he was going to do that. So no money from the city, no money from foundations who felt that they had poured money into West Philadelphia to no avail. So our trustees, who were incredible, really allowed us to use university resources, but that meant it was money that we weren't spending on the English department or on the next program of whatever. And it was fungible dollars, and we made choices.
And so what did the university then, with these fungible sources, what did the university offer the community?
Well, we started pretty small. We put together a community and university citizen 40th Street Task Force. That was literally the street that almost divided the campus from the university. And we gave them 90 days to come up with extraordinary transformational interventions. And they did. They relit the sidewalks. They cleaned the graffiti. They widened the streets. All in 90 days, they changed the whole streetscape. And so people started coming out more. The town met the gown. On those corners in 40th Street, they planned and we ultimately built some critical pillar institutions, a phenomenal supermarket in, you know, a neighborhood that had virtually food deserts, very, very little fresh food, a phenomenal movie theater, a project with Robert Redford to create the first or second Sundance Cinema project that would also have public spaces during the day for community, for school children and the like. His view and mine that cinema could be the kind of Carnegie Library of the 21st century if it were treated properly and engage the community. All in 90 days they came up with this. So it was a phenomenal beginning.
So that was all in 90 days they came up with these ideas. How long in total did it take to see progress?
We started to see real progress in about 5 or 6 years. Because we already had plans for the public school and we took responsibility for a lot of the other public schools. Ours, excuse me, ours became a teaching school for a lot of the teachers in the Philadelphia school system. And we insisted that you could only go to that, your child could only go to that school if you lived in the neighborhood. So that led to housing rehab, people moving back in. That gave businesses the capacity. And I'd say, Jonathan, the second really big thing we did, which was quick, we created a complete Higher West Philadelphia First program at the university. So we owned 5 hospitals. We were sending our hospital laundry out everywhere. We helped a Philadelphia entrepreneur, a West Philadelphia entrepreneur with the Wharton School's assistance, develop a laundry that would take all of our hospital laundry. It's now the largest laundry in Philadelphia. It only hires West Philadelphia residents. You can see that transformation very quickly when the university uses itself as an economic engine for change.
I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dr. Judith Roden, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and the author of her latest book. How many books have you written now?
14.
Her 14th book, The Resilience Dividend, published by Public Affairs. And we've been talking about your time as president of the University of Pennsylvania, which is a good sort of foundation to talk about your book. And you begin your introduction with a story about Superstorm Sandy, which struck, as we all know, New York City in October of 2012. Where were you at the time and what were you concerned about?
Well, I was in Beijing at the time and my flight was canceled, so I couldn't get back. But before I knew my flight was canceled, I had no idea how bad it was. And I was frantically trying to reach my chief of staff, my executive assistant, anybody in the office. But Rockefeller is located in the area of New York that was taken down in terms of the electric grid for a week. And so we couldn't make contact with anybody for a while. And for me, it was terrifying.
And so how did you react when you were then asked to co-chair the NYS 2100 Commission that was formed by Governor Cuomo?
I thought it was a terrific opportunity because Rockefeller has been working around the world in cities building resilience. As you know well, Jonathan, we began in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, when our shared pal, Darren Walker, and I
now president of the Ford Foundation.
Got deeply engaged in helping New Orleans develop the Unified New Orleans Plan, which they are still acting on. But it was really a lesson in building all kinds of resilience and what the physical infrastructure would need to be, what community cohesion would need to be rebuilt. The education system was completely flawed, and there was no diversity of an economy, and so the economy had to be totally rebuilt. With that as our primer, and then the significant work that we were doing in Asia, in the Asian Cities Climate Change Resilience Network, we knew that we could bring to New York a lot of the learning. And we saw that New York was starting to veer towards build back the same, which is the human instinct. You know, everybody wants it to be the same again as quickly as possible. And through this commission, we introduced the mantra which has permeated the New York and New Jersey rebuild, which is build back better. we can't always rebuild the same. And so we've got to recover in a way that allows us to revitalize and adapt and grow differently.
Now, is there a certain amount of skepticism about using resilience as an approach to a problem?
Well, sometimes people think that it's too expensive, that building and preparing, after all, resilience building starts with preparedness. So often the money doesn't get spent until a bad thing happens, and then it's all spent in the recovery. If for every $4 spent in recovery, if you had only spent one of those dollars in preparedness, you would have been better off. And so what we're trying to do is really reframe the way people are thinking to understand, just like when you're worried about the flu, which you just wrote about, you get a vaccine. Here, you need to vaccinate by preparing for any crisis. You know, after 9/11, as we found on the Cuomo Commission, lots of businesses put their generators in the basement because they thought the next crisis was going to come from the air.
Right.
And then, of course, they all flooded out during Sandy. So the notion of resilience is not to look in the rearview mirror. Crisis is becoming the new normal, and it's any kind of crisis, whether it's a cyber attack or terrorism or a flood or a storm or whatever. And so if you're only preparing for one type, you're not making the resilience investment that leads to what we call the resilience dividend.
Now, some of those investments, you say there are hard and soft solutions. Can you give us some examples? Give an example of a hard solution and an example of a soft solution.
So a hard solution is structurally reinforcing the edges, building the levees back to be better in and more resilient in New Orleans. Soft solutions, just to stay with New York and New Orleans, would be restoring wetlands. The Meadowlands solution is going to be a soft and hard infrastructure solution because it's going to allow more water in, and in really good and meaningful ways, but build a transportation and recreational infrastructure that also substitutes for hard edges in hard infrastructure resilient ways. The dividend is that you're getting better transportation, we'll have better bike paths, we'll have better access for the community, while at the same time building both hard and soft resilient infrastructure.
Does it always take a dramatic incident or noticeable event to bring about resilience?
I wish it didn't. It is easier to convince both elected officials and the general public when a crisis happens. So clearly, we don't want to waste a crisis, whatever kind it is. That's when the resources may be most significant. That's when public attention is heightened. And so we need to use that as long as we use it to recover more effectively, better, and to revitalize. But we see lots of examples in the U.S. and around the world where it didn't take a crisis. So the Boston Marathon bombing is on everybody's mind now.
I was going to ask you about that, so go ahead.
As the trial gets underway, Boston, for the last 4 or 5 years, has been rehearsing and planning and preparing for any crisis, whether it's a hurricane, a nor'easter, a terrorist attack. And they've been integrating all of their services, transportation, communication, government, and actually practicing. So they use an event, a sports team wins a pennant, or 4th of July celebration as a rehearsal. So they were amazingly prepared for the marathon bombing. And as you know, although some people died immediately, everyone who was hurt, who didn't die immediately, got to a hospital within 19 minutes, and none of those who got to hospitals died. That was the result of preparation and rehearsal.
So now that we're on Boston, then I have to ask you about two other situations that where we could put your resilience expert hat on to see if there are anything, if there's anything that can be done or could be done better. So yesterday, the world marched with France and the people in Paris as a result of the 3 days of the terrorist attacks there. How does Paris bounce back, become resilient from something like that? just broadly speaking.
We actually will get to work on that because we have just selected Paris before this bombing in the second cohort of our 100 Resilient Cities initiative. So as we work with them on their resilience building strategies, this is going to be very front of mind for them. Mm-hmm. And we will be bringing in experts to work with them to actually build a strategy around this, but around the other things that are confronting them. In their application, they talked about aging infrastructure, but it did also talk about community unrest, about the inequity in their populations, about the issues around different communities and misunderstandings. So they are poised to work on this.
And when you say they, are you talking about official government officials, or we're talking about NGOs and your sort of fellow foundation chiefs over there in France?
So, Jonathan, that's a critical question. No, we had 800 applications for the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative, and so far we've only selected 75. And no city is selected unless they have many sectors of society participating in the application process and really working together and agreeing to work together on developing and then implementing a strategy. So it has to be government, it must be business, and it is always civil society, whether it's universities or NGOs. And in that collaboration, you start to see really extraordinary opportunities for transformation.
And to bring you here, back here at home in New York over the last several weeks, we've seen the mayor and the police department going, you know, head to head in disagreement. And a lot of people are wondering, how's this going to solve itself? Is there a resilience lesson here that could be applied?
Yes. So New York is in the first cohort of our 100 Resilient Cities, and I am hoping that this will become – this was not obviously part of an application a year ago. What we are seeing in New York – and I must say I saw this after Sandy as well – New York is still, unfortunately, pretty siloed in its responding. So the government has one set of responses, the police force another, the business community a third, community organizations a fourth. And resilience building, particularly around this issue, is going to require, as I think you eloquently wrote about, not only, as you said, people seeing each other across the divide, but engaging the community in this. This isn't just about de Blasio and Bratton versus the police. This is really about us, all the people who live in New York and are citizens and must have a voice and a role in how this gets fixed. Marching and protesting is step one, but staying engaged and demanding a role in how this obviously plays out will be the difference in whether we are made more resilient by it or not.
Judith Roden, I didn't even get to ask you about Medellin. Next conversation.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Rockefeller Foundation President Judith Roden about the role of resilience in society and how different communities have adapted to catastrophic challenges like hurricanes and economic distress. She's the author of The Resilience Dividend, Being Strong in a World Where Things Go Wrong. It's published by Public Affairs. Again, Judith, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Jonathan.